Welcome to the Sanctuary Life Podcast, where we take you through a day in the life of animal rescues and sanctuaries across the country. Whether you are an experienced sanctuary staffer, one of the countless volunteers who work so hard at sanctuaries each day, or someone who just loves animals, we hope this journey can give you a behind-the-scenes peek into just what it takes to live the sanctuary life. Now, here's your host, Brandon Feisner, co-founder of Louisville, Kentucky's Butterfly Valley Rescue and Sanctuary.
We are back after a short break on the Sanctuary Life Podcast. Unfortunately, when you run a sanctuary, you never know what life is going to throw at you next. And this past week, our Butterfly Valley Rescue and Sanctuary was dealt a massive blow when we had to say goodbye to our adorable little cleft lip cutie named Snuffy. I want to thank all of our followers, all of the other sanctuaries, everyone who reached out to us during this incredibly difficult time. There are no words to describe the impact that losing a rescue animal can have on you. And the only thing that really helps heal those wounds is time. Don't forget, we have our all new Sanctuary Shorts episodes where you can call in and submit your own rescue stories. For more information on how to submit your story, visit our Instagram page and look for Sanctuary Shorts. For this week's episode, we head to North Texas to meet Lauren, who founded Hodgepodge Farm and Rescue in Argyle, Texas. Lauren, I've read that you grew up riding horses, participating in 4-H, interning for veterinarians, and getting a degree in animal science. You've spent most of your life engaged in rescuing animals of varying kinds, and you say that a horse was your very first word and the only thing that you ever asked for at every birthday or holiday involving gift giving. So Lauren, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. We're so grateful to be here. We appreciate the opportunity for sure.
Can you tell us a little bit about this hodgepodge of an adventure that began in the mind of a little girl obsessed with horses and has just grown into this magnificent farm and sanctuary that just continues to kind of grow?
Absolutely. It's my absolute favorite thing to talk about. I am born and raised a very, very New York City New Yorkers who had probably only ever seen a horse in Central Park under an NYPD officer or two, which makes total sense that then they would have this child who was completely and utterly obsessed with horses. I'm pretty sure since birth, my mother would tell you. But I'm very fortunate that I had parents who were kind and also dumb enough to support that passion. And, so I started taking riding lessons when I was 5 years old, and, I was grateful that we didn't have a lot of money. And so I had to work to ride. And so I learned really truly from the ground up about cleaning stalls and managing tack and, doing the hard work to go along with the riding. But I also grew up in a house where, we had a dog, and then I would find a bunny in the backyard. And it was just inherently in me that if I came across an animal that in my mind needed help, it was coming home. And so I was constantly finding creatures that kind of needed us. Even up to in college, I hand raised a goat in my dorm room. Spoiler alert. Colleges don't actually want you to have goats in your dorm room. And so Saranac was his name, and everyone kind of knew him, and he would walk on a leash around campus with me and go to class. And then when he was old enough to be weaned, we were able to place him at a living farm, and he lived out his days there. But it's kind of always been intrinsically within me to help creatures along the way. If there's a turtle in the road, I will stop and risk life and limb to get the turtle out of the road, and always have. But it was always the horses were really my main focus and my primary objective, and everything that I did growing up, if I had a say in it, had something to do with horses. So I was a horse kid in 4-H, and I worked for equine veterinarians when I was in high school, and I decided by the fifth grade that I was going to be a veterinarian, and I decided where I was going to go to college because it was the best at the time, and it had a vet school, and I worked my hiney off to get there so that I could continue to help animals. Unfortunately, college was a lot harder than I thought, so vet school didn't exactly work out, darn you, organic chemistry. But I didn't let that stop me from still endeavoring to continue to try to make my own way in helping animals. And as it turns out, our farm vet and I joke around quite a bit that I probably would have been a really good vet, but a terrible business person, because I would have chastised every human I came across that didn't do things the right way. So it's probably all worked out for the best for me to be running a rescue to help animals instead of actually being a veterinarian.
So how in the world did the daughter of two New Yorkers wind up in North Texas?
That is a very embarrassing story, but I was 21 years old and I met a guy, and that guy was being relocated with his job to North Texas. And so I followed a guy and I married that guy, and then I bought a horse that really was needing to be rescued. And we still have him. He is my heart horse for sure. And he's kind of the center of the universe. And then that guy and I had a human kiddo, and that human kiddo is about to start his senior year of high school. And although his father and I are long since not married, he is obligated to stay here through his senior year of high school. And then we will actually be relocating the rescue much further north, because it's really, really, really hard to have livestock in North Texas.
Yes, and that's a topic we will definitely get to. of all the places we've talked to people about, North Texas is a place that I can imagine has its difficulties.
Very challenging. Yes.
So obviously with you having that significant background in equines, horses are a big part of what you all do at Hodgepodge Farm and Rescue, but they aren't the only animals that you care for from what I've seen. How many different animals do you all currently care for, and what are some of the species that call Hodgepodge home?
Sure. So as of this moment in time, and it changes pretty regularly, we have 19 animals in residence across a couple of properties that we've had to expand to because more needs, more space. So we have horses, we have a mule, a miniature mule, we have sheep, we have alpaca, we have a pig, and we have some dogs. Although we are not a dog rescue, nor are we generally considered any specific kind of rescue, thus the name Hodgepodge. We are a hodgepodge of creatures, because if it has four legs and a pulse and it needs somewhere to go, and it's within any walking distance of me, my family would tell you, I'm going to say yes, and I'm going to go pick it up, and I'm going to find a way to give it a home and take care of it. So we end up with anything that needs us when they need us, if we can make a way.
Yes, and I love the name Hodgepodge, because I feel like it fits appropriately for a rescue. I feel like no matter what you intend to start out as, a hodgepodge is what we all end up becoming in most cases.
I think you're absolutely right. I think I just got lucky to steal the name before anybody else got to it.
Yeah, so obviously caring for and rescuing multiple different species, like you talked about, presents numerous challenges. What would you say is the most challenging species that you care for at Hodgepodge, and why?
I will say with absolute certainty that the horses are definitely the hardest. Horses are just a very hard creature to manage. They are very poorly designed, frankly. So a lot of people don't know that horses cannot regurgitate at all. So their digestive tracts are unidirectional. So if it goes in their mouth, it has to come out the other end. And that can create problems very frequently, particularly when you live in tough weather conditions like we do. They are also just prone to injuring themselves and concocting ways to be sick or hurt or you name it, and a horse will find a way. There's sort of always the running gag in the horse community that if you think you've put up enough protective mechanisms to keep them safe, they're going to tell you to hold their shoe and find a new way to hurt themselves. And I have to say, after 40 plus years with horses, I think that's an accurate statement for sure.
So keeping horses safe is a lot like keeping goats in a pen.
Exactly. It's an impossible task. You can't keep goats penned up, and you can't keep horses from injuring themselves, no matter how hard you try. I think that's spot on.
So what would you say? Obviously, you have 5 or 6 different species there. If someone was just starting an animal rescue or sanctuary, and they were looking for something that is... of the 5 species or 6 species that you have, looking for an easiest species, what would you say has been the easiest for you all?
People are probably going to think I'm insane, but sheep are absolutely the easiest, and particularly so we have at present the 2 sheep that we have in residence are what are called Barbados sheep, and they are a Caribbean breed of meat sheep. So that breed is bred specifically to be consumed by humans, which we personally feel is disgusting. But they are a different kind of sheep in that they are not a hair sheep, which most people are used to seeing hair sheep. So when they see our sheep, they think that they're goats. In fact, our first one that we took in, Wheezy, we got a call from a city animal shelter asking if we could take a goat. And when I went to pick her up, I looked at her and went, "That's not a goat." So to the untrained eye, most people would think that they are actually goats because they don't have a big, thick, woolly coat. Therefore, they don't need to be shorn. And the difference with sheep and goats in our experience is twofold. One, sheep are blade eaters rather than root pullers when it comes to grazing. So they are less damaging to your paddocks and pastures in terms of managing your grasses and keeping your pastures healthy. And two, in our experience, again, and I'm sure there are people who have had different experiences, but as you pointed out, goats will jump out of any enclosure you put up. We used to joke that our goats that we had were spring loaded because they could get out of anything, no matter how tall we constructed it. But the sheep have never tried to jump at all. So we don't really ever have to manage going and rounding them back up after they've gone on naughty adventures like we have with goats, or we've had with our pig, or other creatures and species that we've had. So my vote is Caribbean breeds of meat sheep are the easiest because you don't even have to shear them. They're pretty low maintenance and they're very, very, very fun and sweet.
And it's interesting that you say that, because we tell people all the time here at our rescue, having both goats and sheep, that if we would have rescued sheep before we rescued goats, I don't know that we would be a goat rescue primarily. We probably would have stuck with sheep.
I think that's very valid. I think most people don't really know that sheep really are pretty low maintenance, as it turns out. I agree with you. I would definitely go with sheep over goats any day of the week. But if they need us, they need us. So,
yes, absolutely. So I know that the 3 R's, rescue, rehabilitate, and rehome, are the primary objectives of what you all do at HodgePodge. Obviously, it takes various skills for all 3 of these objectives. Tell us a little more about kind of each one and what it takes to successfully rescue, rehabilitate, and rehome.
Absolutely. So rescue, in our definition, comes in a lot of shapes and forms. We work with rescue partners across the country. Everyone sort of has a different view on that. Our view is that if an animal is in need in any way, whether that is a human who has a pet or a livestock or something that they can no longer care for or need help with, we will take owner surrenders where a lot of rescues will not. If animals end up in a shelter and that shelter does not have the facilities to provide for them appropriately, like with Wheezy or sheep, that is a rescue. We will go and retrieve them from suboptimal facilities. We have also pulled particularly horses from auctions, from goats, but from what are referred to as kill pens, as well as we have our number one objective is to get ahead of that, particularly where the horses are concerned, and try to intercede before people take them to auction to sort of cut the legs off of the horse slaughter pipeline. So local intervention with people who can no longer care for their horses for whatever reason is always a better solution than waiting until they're at the auction and they're at risk at that point. So we try very, very hard to be out in our community so that people know who we are, so that they know they have an option other than just taking a horse to an auction or any animal for that matter and dumping them there. We'd rather they come straight to us from the get-go and cut out that sort of auction house slaughter people, yucky stuff. So that's rescue. It comes in a lot of formats for us, and every one of our residents has a very different story for how their rescue transpired. And there are people, I'm sure, who would say that some of them were not actually rescued. Our definition is they didn't have a permanent safe home, so they were rescued. And that's pretty much how we look at it. Rehabilitation is a horse of many colors. So every animal that enters our gates has a different background. And we look at rehabilitation in a lot of formats. We look at, obviously, physical and medical needs are number one, but there are also emotional needs that come along with every animal that ever comes our way. And we find that a lot of places really focus solely on those physical needs and sort of eschew the actual emotional component of things. And to us, that's really unfair. That's not setting them up for having a long-term success story. If you don't know who they are or invest the time into their emotional needs, you're not able to then rehome them to someone who's prepared to deal with everything that has to do with that animal. So we focus on physical and emotional. And sometimes that is a very short shift and they're not emotionally shattered. They haven't had really terrible experiences, so it's not as hard to rehabilitate emotionally. Sometimes their physical rehabilitation is very, very lengthy, sometimes almost impossible. So we also have here at HodgePodge what we call our sanctuary crew, which are permanent residents. And they are permanent residents either because their medical needs are so extreme that we don't have feel like it's going to be safe to rehome them elsewhere where those medical needs will be addressed. Those are really kind of severe medical questions or issues, or where they have serious, serious emotional problems that would not translate into another home or facility. Again, not putting that animal back at risk because we are recognizing what their physical and emotional needs are and not sure that we could find a home that would be able to tolerate all of those things. So we have a sanctuary that provides for permanent care for animals that just don't have the ability to be rehomed for various reasons. But the rehome part is really, really critical because sanctuary is insanely expensive, frankly. Just the cost of maintaining a property, maintaining feed, maintaining day-to-day needs, ongoing medical care, it's a very, very, very expensive proposition. So like a lot of us in rescue, we would love for the rescue to be our full-time job, but it doesn't pay for itself by any means. So my husband and I both have day jobs that actually pay for 94% of the expenses of HodgePodge. We're really lousy at fundraising and really lousy at asking for help. But the work is important. And as we continue to grow, we are having to build that muscle and work on that skill to try to improve because we can only house so many here. So that rehoming portion, it becomes more and more critical as we grow, because eventually you run out of resources that then provide for additional animals. So there's a lot of cap out that can happen at a lot of rescues that we work with and that we know, because there is only so much to go around. So being able to find appropriate homes to care for animals ongoing and for the rest of their lives is really critical to us continuing to grow and be successful.
Absolutely. And I love your definition of rescue, because I do think it's important to take in those animals that need help in any way, because it's not just, again, in that moment, that animal may not be in immediate danger of harm or anything, but you never know what an extra week in that environment or anything else could be. So I love that definition, the way you all look at things there.
Thank you. Exactly.
I noticed that on your all's logo, you have a phrase, and I absolutely love it. It says, "For life or longer." What can you tell us about what that means?
That was a phrase that frankly popped into my head a very long time ago. And I think it was really born out of just absolutely loving each individual creature for who they are independently, and recognizing that when you take on a sentient being, when they become part of your life, you are responsible for that life forever. It never becomes where you're not connected to that creature in some way, shape, or form. So for us, our sanctuary crew obviously is here for life, but it's longer because we never stop loving them. Even when they leave us, even when they cross the rainbow bridge, there's a lot of lessons that come from every creature that has been in our lives. And I believe that those creatures continue to provide for us in ways that we almost don't recognize sometimes, and sometimes we do. When we rehome animals, we continue to follow up and ensure that they are truly safe and cared for. And every adoption goes with a contract that we have right of first refusal. So if for any reason the person who adopts an animal from us cannot continue to care for them, they are to come back to HodgePodge and we will find a space. We will find a way for them. Our obligation does not end when we rehome something or when we rehabilitate something, or even when they pass on. We continue to honor them for the rest of our days, because that's our responsibility in the way that we view it.
Yes. And there's so many important lessons that come from continuing to tell those stories of those residents. And there's so many important lessons that those residents, I feel like every one of them, at least here, every one of them prepares us for the next one. And that's such an important part.
I couldn't agree with you more. There are lessons that we've gained from every creature who has ever crossed our path, even the ones that never come to live here, but that we somehow are engaged with. There's a lesson that we take from every one of them, and we continue to carry on. And your point about sharing their stories is also really important.
So I know one of the biggest goals at HodgePodge as you continue to expand and grow, and that is to eventually end the slaughter of America's horses. And this was a topic that I was blissfully ignorant of until I did an episode with Red Feather Equine Sanctuary last year. Being here we're in Kentucky and home of the Kentucky Derby, and everything is like horses, horses, horses. And I had no clue that there was this whole pipeline of slaughtered horses. And it is horrific when people realize the reality of it. But what can you tell our listeners about that current practice of slaughter related to horses in America, and what they can do to help stop it, hopefully?
Absolutely. So you bring up a really important point, Brandon, which is most of American citizens have no idea that this happens. And it really is kind of a very dirty, disgusting underbelly. You bring up that, you know, being in Kentucky and the Kentucky Derby, the winner of the 1987 Kentucky Derby was a horse named Ferdinand, and his life ended in a slaughterhouse overseas. So even our American hero horses who make it to the top of their sport are not able to be kept safe their entire lives. And it's really, really raw and gross. We don't eat horse meat in America. We have not done so in the history of our country for the most part, but other countries do consume horse meat. The good news is, in recent history, the European Union finally banned the consumption of American horse meat. And that is because we medicate our horses. We worm them, we vaccinate, we give them all kinds of supplements and feeds, things that are not safe for human beings to consume. And so the European Union recognized that they were poisoning humans by allowing the import of American horse meat for the consumption. So they put a stop to it. That has made a significantly positive impact on the number of horses that are shipped for slaughter each year. Up until 2013, we were actually still slaughtering horses in the United States. We had three remaining slaughter plants that were in existence here in the U.S., two in Texas, one in Illinois. Those were closed in 2013. And a lot of us who knew about it were celebrating and thinking this was the greatest thing that could ever happen. Unfortunately, what we did not account for is that all that that did was then move us to shipping horses across the borders into Canada and Mexico for the purposes of slaughter. So we weren't slaughtering them here in the States, but we were sending that exact same amount of horses into countries that bordered us for the purposes of slaughter. We still do that today, 10 years later. In a positive tract, the USDA publishes on a weekly basis how many horses or how many animals in general, but obviously I'm a little focused on horses, how many horses are shipped for the purposes of slaughter into Canada and Mexico. The slaughter numbers have never been lower than they are at present, which is phenomenal news and something that we are all trumpeting and very excited about. But we are still shipping horses every single week, and we are shipping horses of every breed, every age, every gender, every size. There's sort of a colloquialism about that it's only the old and sickly. And so it really doesn't matter what we here at HodgePodge refer to as the less dead, right? If it's old and sick, people just don't really care quite as much. The reality is there are babies. There are thoroughbreds coming right out of Kentucky, although less and less so all the time because the Jockey Club has done a really, really strong job of sanctioning trainers, breeders, owners who are sending horses to slaughter. They are actually stepping up and doing their part. Other breed associations have not done so. And so 70% of the horses that are shipped for slaughter at present are American quarter horses, which blows people's minds and they tend to not believe me, but that's an actual fact. So there has been on the books in Washington, D.C., something called the SAFE Act for many, many, many years now. And what the SAFE Act says is it basically makes it illegal to ship horses for the purposes of slaughter. We have been advocating and trying to get the SAFE Act passed for a very long time. And unfortunately, our politicians just don't seem as focused on horses as people like me are. But we're never giving up hope, and we're never going to stop, and we're never going to slow down. But what we as humans in our own communities can really do to make an impact is if we all were to adopt from rescues first and foremost, that makes a tremendous impact because it makes people like us able to save more horses if we are able to rehome. And if we can shatter this image that the only horses that are ending up in slaughter and or at rescue are old and sickly, that would go a long way towards people opening up their minds to the concept of adopting a horse, that these horses can be everything that every horse they go to buy or import from overseas can be. Just because it was rescued doesn't mean it's something that isn't capable of having a very, very meaningful future for its owners and riders and equestrians in general. So we have a lot of work to do in terms of shattering the image of what people think is happening in slaughter. We have a lot of work to do in terms of educating people that slaughter is happening. It's happening right this second as you and I talk. There are currently today 7 people in the U.S. that have contracts to ship horses for the purposes of slaughter. And what most people don't understand is that they have a specific weight amount that they have to meet each week to maintain those contracts. And come hell or high water, they are going to ship that weight of horses each week, and we may never see those horses. So we have to start adopting. We have to start buying locally. We have to cut those folks off at the pass so that there's no more supply for their demand.
Yes, and I think those are some very good tips to hopefully curb that as much as possible. Obviously, like we both said, I think it's something that so many people in this country have no clue is happening. And that's the first step, raising that awareness, helping people understand. And honestly, just like the transport of cattle, and just like the transport of pigs, and just like the transport of chickens, when you're loading those horses onto trucks now to transport longer distances across the border, you're just further increasing the suffering and everything before they get to that ultimate destination.
Exactly. Exactly. And this will really make your skin crawl, but most of them are loaded into cattle trucks, which are not tall or wide enough for horses. So it's even more torturous. And I'm not saying it's okay for any other species. Please don't misunderstand me, but it is appreciably worse for them because they are not being shipped in containers that actually suit them. And even more disgusting is that when we ship horses into Canada, they will live export horses in wooden crates. So big, giant wooden boxes, those horses will go live on planes without hay, without feed, without water, on flights for up to 24 hours before they then are put into a plant and slaughtered. So we are really horrible, really, really horrible to horses. Yeah.
Oh man, I don't know where you go from there, because that is
sorry.
Wow. No, I mean, I think it's something that, like I said, that people need to understand the reality of, because until people see it firsthand, it's just like if slaughterhouses had glass walls, people wouldn't eat what we eat, and I think it continues as we can continue to raise that awareness. Hopefully, we can kind of buck that trend and move away from some of that.
Absolutely.
Speaking of horses, and one of the amazing residents that you have that we have to discuss is Huckleberry, who loves a good butt scratch, and landed you the honor of being named an animal hero by the Dodo. What can you tell us about Huckleberry and what it's like to try to control that 1,500-pound toddler?
Huck is probably an episode or 20 all to himself. Huck is actually a really, really great horse rescue story and probably going to always be one of my favorites. So a few years back, kill pens started popping up on social media, and we could talk about that for a very long time. It turns out that they're mostly kind of nonsense, and they use a lot of emotional manipulation to get people to buy horses with lots of threats of the truck is coming and look how sick they are and those kinds of things. And I will admit that I got caught up in it too. And so I was sitting at my desk at my day job one day, and there was a post about from a local kill pen about 10 horses that the slaughter truck was coming imminently. And I looked, and there were comments and people talking about 9 of the 10 horses, and Huck was the 10th. And no one wanted him. He was frankly ugly and what's called U-necked, which means like he had kind of a U shape to his neck. And he was skinny and brown, and he had the most epic side eye I have ever seen. He is still to this day the king of side eye. And I felt bad for him. He was like the kid who gets picked last for kickball. Just no one wanted this poor horse. And I thought, we can make a space. We can find a way. So for $325, I bought Huckleberry. And at the time, we didn't have a truck or a trailer. I didn't actually have a plan. It was probably one of the least responsible rescues I've ever done. But we figured it out. We found a quarantine partner, and I found a shipper who brought him there. that night. And so I bought him sight unseen, and I had no idea what we were getting into. And he was very, very, very sick. He ended up being at quarantine for 7 weeks because he was so very sick and had to have multiple rounds of antibiotics, which happens frequently for horses that go through these auctions. They just share communicable diseases. But when I got to the quarantine to visit him for the very first time, I took him on a walk. And as soon as we got out of the fenced-in area, he immediately just plopped down and started rolling around like a lunatic on the lead with me standing there going, oh, goodness, what did I just get us into? Because this is a lot of silliness right out of the gate, and you're so sick and so thin and so skinny. What are we getting into? I fully expected Huck was probably a thoroughbred, an off-track thoroughbred, or standard bred racehorse, just because of his coloring. And that's typically, those are frequently breeds that you find in these situations. But he didn't have a lip tattoo, and he didn't have a freeze brand on his neck. So we really weren't quite sure what he was. He was also very, very, very tall. He is a big, big boy. When he finally cleared quarantine and when he came home, I had my vet out immediately, and he ended up being only 8 years old. And other than having that upper respiratory infection stuff and being skinny, we couldn't find anything else that was really physically wrong with him. We had to treat him for what's called EPM, and that's a neurological disease that can be picked up from the feces of opossums. And he had some indicators that he was having some EPM symptoms, so we treated him for that. But otherwise, he was 8 years old. He was perfectly healthy. And then we scanned him for a microchip, because we do that with every animal that comes into our possession in case they were stolen or someone is looking for them. We want to make sure that we do right by them. Huck had a microchip that it was a microchip in Germany. So every horse microchip, it starts with a digit indicator of the country. And his was from Germany, which left my vet and I scratching our heads, because that is very unusual to find. Through a lot of internet sleuthing and a lot of assistance in internet sleuthing, we were able to actually track down that he is a registered Oldenburg Warmblood, which is a pretty rare breed of warmblood here in the US and very expensive. And through that, we were also able to track down his original breeder and talk with her. We're friends with her. She follows him and keeps up with him. We learned from there, we were able to track his entire backstory. So from the day he was born, we have actually pictures of him from when he was born, while he was growing up, that she provided us, and then where he went from there, and then from there, and then how he ultimately ended up at this auction in this kill pen. So through all of that, though, Huck really became Huck, and that was not his original name. His original name was Scarlatti. He does not respond to that at all. It doesn't seem to be the thing that he is interested in. He is a very specific case of, despite having no real medical issues, he has more emotional issues than any of the rest of our horses combined. He is kind of a basket case, frankly. He's very, very, very silly and very, very, very goofy. And we were fortunate that we were in contact with someone at the Dodo who asked if we had any animals that we thought would make a good story. And so I provided some videos of Huck, you know, popping a yoga ball and then spinning it around like a hula hoop, and Huck playing with a rubber chicken, and Huck using me to scratch his butt. That's a daily occurrence. He is a ridiculous giant goofball and has more personality than I have hair on my head. And he is such a joy to have. He's also extremely high maintenance, and he is one who is a permanent sanctuary resident because he does not handle change of any kind. Right now, he's kind of having a temper tantrum because we recently rescued two new horses that desperately needed us, and he is big mad that mom is spending time with them and not with him. So Huck is a lot to take, but also an absolute blast, and he is an example of breaking that belief that it is only the old and sick and poorly that end up in those situations. He couldn't be more the opposite of all of those things. He is a very young, very capable, very well-bred horse who ended up in a really bad situation. And we're extremely, extremely fortunate to have found him. And it's an honor to get to be his person. It doesn't come easily, but it's totally worth it.
And I think it's amazing that you all were able to get his backstory, like track that back, get backstory, get pictures of him when he was born, because that story is, sometimes that's the hardest part of rescue, is that you have no clue what the backstory is on so many of the animals that you take in. And to be able to understand that and have that relationship with where he came from and everything is absolutely incredible.
It's very rare, and we are extremely, extremely grateful. It's one of the reasons why, you know, we're big proponents of spay and neuter your animals. Number one, always, always, always. None of us should be making more animals. There are too many in existence that need safe places. But number two is microchip your animals. Every animal that comes to HodgePodge gets microchipped, and that microchip gets registered. If you give an animal away or you rehome it, you need to make sure that whoever you rehomed it to re-registers it so that that animal can be found, because animals do get stolen. Animals do run away. So make sure that you can find your animal, because it also makes people like us and what we do a lot easier in terms of having those backgrounds, having information about them makes rehabilitating them so much easier than going in blindly and never knowing.
Absolutely. So now that we've heard Huck's story, are there any other residents that just their story really stands out as far as the impact it has made either on you personally or on HodgePodge Farm Rescue in general that you would like to share?
Oh, gosh, I would tell you every single one of their stories, but I think Wheezy is probably the other one that she is so special that it defies logic. So Wheezy is our resident, one of our resident Barbados sheep. She is the one that was at that city shelter and they thought she was a goat. Sheep are notoriously afraid of humans because we are predators and they are prey and they know it. So when I rescued Wheeze, they literally had her in a dog kennel and they dragged her out of the dog kennel. We were so new in getting things set up. In fact, we had just purchased this property. I had to rent a pickup truck and put a large dog crate in the bed of it to go get her, which is suboptimal at best. And then she actually came to live here at this property before we, the humans, did. And it took a very, very long time to ever have Wheezy come anywhere near me at all. And then one day she just decided that having human contact was what she wanted. And that was it. And I always am amazed because Wheeze is one that no one is in charge of Wheeze but Wheeze. I can't make her do anything that she doesn't choose to do. And she is now at least 14 years old. So she is ancient for a sheep. Her life expectancy would have been about 10 to 12. So she is about a million years old in sheep years. She still runs to get her dinner every single night. She will come over and we do cuddle puddle with she and Peppa, our pet pig. And if Peppa is getting belly rubs, Wheeze will come over and literally climb on top of me to plop down. But my favorite part about Wheeze is not just how wonderful and sweet and kind she is and how much she just absolutely loves, loves, loves humans after humans were literally going to eat her. But we have a pig farrier specifically who comes to trim Peppa's feet, because pig hooves are different than horse hooves, than cows or goats or sheep. And so we try to get very specific specialized care to make sure our animals get the best. And this gentleman who comes to trim Peppa's feet grew up on a Barbados sheep farm. So he grew up with this particular breed of sheep, and he could not get over that Wheezy came over and wanted cuddles and to be pet and hang out. He said he had never once seen a single Barbados sheep who was at all interested in humans, let alone demanding of human attention. Wheeze is a miracle on so many levels. She has defied death more times than I can count. And she is large and in charge, and whatever Wheeze wants, Wheeze gets, because she is the diva of this property, and I will always defer to Wheeze.
Absolutely. And I love the fact that you talk about how amazed he was that Wheezy came up and was demanding attention. And I think that's something that you see so often when people visit sanctuaries and experience animals for the first time that have lived in a sanctuary, and all they're ever used to is a petting zoo or another environment. And they come in and they're like, everywhere I've ever been, the animals run from me and I have to chase the animals to pet them. We had visitors here yesterday and they said, I've never seen animals flock to people and just cling to people like these do. And it's because they learn that trust. And it's just an incredible thing to witness, especially with animals like Wheezy that didn't have that to begin with.
Exactly. I think, you know, I say this to folks all the time. Animals are grateful. They truly are. And every single animal we have ever taken on has always been grateful. And sometimes they show their gratitude in different ways. We have another Barbados sheep, Elfie, who does not want you to touch her. She is not interested in human contact. But there are moments where she'll come over to me and she'll take a Nilla wafer. That's their favorite treat. Probably not what any veterinarian would tell me they're allowed to have, but it's what she likes. So that's what she gets. And she'll show me her gratitude in her own little ways. So even the ones that aren't super friendly are still grateful and still appreciative of the life that they have, more so than humans, at least in my experience.
Absolutely. It's an awesome thing to see. So one topic, and we talked about this early on, is the challenge of running an animal sanctuary in North Texas. Obviously, each sanctuary we talk to has had their own challenges, whether it's in Southern California or North Carolina or wherever that may be. But when it comes to extreme weather and natural disasters, what can you tell us about trying to run an animal sanctuary smack dab in the middle of the core of all of that?
I would say that we chose very poorly. If there is an extreme type of weather, we have it here. And people don't believe that we have a winter here, or that even that our winter is really rough, but it is. So today it was 109 degrees on the thermometer. With the heat index, it's over 130 degrees. It is extremely humid here. So you have a humidity factor in the summer. You also have it in the winter. So it's a wet cold that feels much, much worse. And we kind of joke that whatever the worst of weather you can possibly have, we have all of it here. So we have had tornadoes come through. We've had hail. We get, it seems like now, an annual ice storm. And it's not snow. It's not sleet. It's straight ice, so much so that one year I actually ice skated on our front yard that we use for pasture for rotating animals through, so I can ice skate on our paddocks. It's pretty wild. It's pretty rough. We lost our lamb last summer to heat stroke. So when you have such extreme weather, it presents challenges all year round. So right now, trying to keep everybody cool enough and hydrated and continuously making sure that they are drinking, that they are not overheating. So we have misters that we put up in the summers. We have big fans that we put out for PEPA. So pigs cannot sweat. The only way that they have to cool themselves is mud. So PEPA has a swimming pool and she has a mud pit, and we refresh her mud pit multiple times a day. Each animal presents a different challenge because the species is different. So the alpacas have to be shorn, and because we have very long summers with extreme heat, they at current are shorn twice. They're shorn early or late spring, and then here late summer, to just try to keep them cool enough to continue to survive. And a lot of it right now for these animals is truly just keeping them surviving, which is not a great feeling to say those words out loud, but our weather is so rough that's what we're doing. So we are relocating the rescue in 282 days. And yes, we are counting. And we Googled where in the United States has the least number of natural disasters. And that's where we're going, because we don't want any more hurricanes or tornadoes or blizzards or extreme temperatures or sandstorms or any of the things that we deal with here in North Texas. We're looking for literal greener pastures, because it's really, really hard to maintain animals in an environment like this, let alone be able to do with them what needs to really be done to continue to rehabilitate and rehome and provide for them appropriately.
Yes, and 282 days comes very fast when it's a big move. What else can you, or is there anything else you can tell us as far as, can you give us a hint as to where the least number of natural disasters is?
Yeah. So if you Google, and I know people are not going to believe this, but I promise if you Google it, the answer to that question, believe it or not, is Syracuse, New York. And Syracuse, New York is in what's called the Finger Lakes region of New York. So it's pretty far from New York City. Most people, when you say New York, think New York City, and then they roll their eyes and think, oh my gosh, it's so expensive and that's impossible. But that part of New York, so it's called Central New York, the Finger Lakes region, is about 6 hours from New York City. So it is northwest. It is not so far northwest that you're in the Buffalo area and the Canadian border, where you're getting all the blizzards and the crazy, crazy cold temperatures that most people would then also think about. You're buffered by mountain ranges from both sides. So there's mountain ranges that protect you from what comes off of the Atlantic, and there's a mountain range that protects you from what comes across from Canada. So you're kind of in this little sweet spot of kind of a buffer zone, so to speak. There's also a tremendous amount of fresh water. It is excellent for agriculture, and the state of New York provides a ton of agricultural incentives. So we will be able to grow our own hay and harvest our own hay, which is a tremendous improvement to our current situation, where we pay $39.50 a bale of hay. Up there, if we were having to buy hay, it would be $6 a bale. So a huge financial difference just in hay alone. New York State also provides so many agricultural incentives. It even impacts the tax rate for folks like us who farm. There's a lot of really, really positive things that will be a areas of improvement for all of our animals, as well as, frankly, for us. There's a lot less bugs, and there's a lot less stabby, jabby, scary things up there than there are here in North Texas. So we haven't bought the property yet. We have been looking. We've got eyes and ears open. We do know who our shipper is, and everyone will be going with us. We know exactly how many trucks we need, who goes on what truck and in what order, and when we're going to have them picked up, and what we're going to do to make sure we're there when they arrive, particularly because Huckleberry will have a coronary about having any life changes. And so we've got part of the plan laid out, and we know where we're going. We just haven't bought the Forever Farm. That's what we're calling it, the Forever Farm. just yet, but any minute now, we know it's the right one's going to pop up and it's going to be amazing. And we're very excited because then we're going to be setting it up so we can have public events and host clinics and visitors and volunteer days and carnivals. And we have lots and lots of big, huge plans for really fun things to involve the community and people from all over who want to be a part of what HodgePodge has to offer.
And for anybody that's wondering, that is quite the move. That is, I just looked it up to see. It's exactly 1,550 miles from Argyle, Texas to Syracuse.
It is, and it is a full, almost exactly 24 hours of drive time, which is why we have a shipper. They are professionals. They drive with multiple drivers. They only stop for gas and to switch drivers out, so they will get everybody there straight through, basically. We will load them in the morning and get on a plane and fly up and meet them when they arrive there because they can do it a lot better, a lot more safely, and a lot faster than we will be able to do ourselves. It's a long one.
That is quite the undertaking. And as we get closer to that, I'd love to talk to you again because I know we've had some other sanctuaries that have moved kind of cross country, but the logistics of it all is always very interesting to me and how you plan that out, because we're not, as I talked to friends of Phillips Fish Sanctuary, it was hard enough when she was moving her fish sanctuary a couple hours away. It's one thing, it's a whole nother thing to move horses and sheep and alpacas, and I can't even imagine the logistics.
I spend a lot of time imagining it, Brandon. I'm a planner by nature. So the not having the farm purchased yet makes me really nervous. And I've had a Zillow search for a while going, and we will be happy to share. And I'm sure there's going to be lots of stories and lots of lessons learned that we would be glad to impart to anybody else who ever endeavors to do this insane thing that we're endeavoring to do.
And there are just some incredible other sanctuaries and resources there in central New York. And it will be exciting for you all to get to that area. And I know that, like I said, it's been a wonderful home for a number of other sanctuaries. So we'll be excited to see how that turns out.
Thank you. Absolutely. We're excited about it for sure.
If someone wants to find out more information about HodgePodge Farm and Rescue, where can they do so?
Sure. So we have a website called hodgepodgerescue.com. We are in desperate need of a lot of updating and additions to that. So please don't think we're just neglecting it. We happen to be a lot better with the animals than we are with the technology. But we also have social media, and we post pretty much every single day on both Facebook, which is HodgePodge Farm, and on Instagram, which is HodgePodge Rescue. Sorry, that's confusing. It's difficult. But if you do find us on social media, you can also click on our link tree, or you can Google link tree HodgePodge Farm. And that will give you the links to everything, including our wish lists with Chewy and Tractor Supply and Amazon. It'll link you to our Facebook and our Instagram, as well as our website. And we're working on trying to find more and more ways to share information, share education, and develop more and more programs and ways for people to be in contact. We also have an email, which is hodgepodgerescue@gmail.com. We can always be contacted there. And we love, love, love when anybody reaches out with questions, concerns, ideas, thoughts. We are an open book. We have no secrets here. We have no magic potions that we follow. We will tell you anything and everything, even all the stuff where we screw up and make mistakes. We are an open book because we're here to help. And part of that requires honesty. So we will always be honest, and we appreciate anyone reaching out for any reason.
So if there's any web designers out there that are looking to help a sanctuary, HodgePodge Farm.
Raising my hand. Yeah, I did it myself on Wix. And again, I'm much better with the animals than I am with technology.
Yes. And I know you touched on some of this, but if our listeners want to help support HodgePodge specifically in your mission to rescue, rehabilitate, and rehome, what are some of the ways that they can support you all?
First, let me say we are grateful for any and all support of any kind that we receive. Likes, comments, shares, direct messages, any interactions, help. A lot of people don't know that social media really truly is a popularity contest. So the more interactions you get, likes, comments, shares, etc., the more it gets visible for more people. And so it brings more people. So those things that seem so small are actually really big and really helpful. But if you feel compelled and want to purchase things that come directly to the crew, you can shop on our wish lists at Amazon or Chewy or Tractor Supply. And we have things of every price point, of every kind, for every creature who resides here at the farm. And we assure you that all of those things go directly to the animals. We don't eat horse cookies here ourselves. We've tried them once or twice, but not anymore. And then if you feel obligated or compelled or just want to be generous and kind, we also always are grateful for financial donations. We are a 501c3 registered nonprofit with the IRS. So you would actually get a tax deduction and you'll get a receipt from us. And you can do that via PayPal, via Venmo. We run fundraisers on Facebook and or Instagram when we have urgent issues, not necessarily on a constant basis. We try very hard to reserve requests for finances until we really have to, which is not a great business model. And that's why we fund 94% of it ourselves. But it is hard to raise funds and it's hard to ask for help, and something we definitely need to get better at for sure. But if there are other methods that people use or are interested in finding out about how to support us, we are always open and would love any thoughts, ideas, or suggestions about ways we can do that better as well.
And we've got to get them to not have to do 94% of that, or they might have to try a few more of those horse biscuit.
Yeah, the humans can go without. It's fine.
So I will also try to link all of the links to your old social media and everything, and Huckleberry's story on the dodo and all that in the show notes so people can easily find that. Lauren, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been a wonderful conversation. We appreciate all that you are doing to make this world a better place, not only for the amazing animals that call Hodgepodge home, but for all the other equines and animals around the country that you are helping with.
Thank you so much, Brandon. Thank you for having us. Thank you for what you're doing and making the world better for every animal that comes across your path. You know, we may not make the world entirely better, but we make each of their individual worlds better, and that really matters.
Thank you for listening to the Sanctuary Life Podcast, presented by Butterfly Valley Rescue and Sanctuary. To find out more about our podcast and how you can be a part of it, visit our webpage at butterflyvalleyrescue.com/podcast or join us on social media at Sanctuary Life Podcast. If you enjoyed this week's episode, please remember to download the episode and recommend us to family and friends. See you next time.